Hey Podnuts, Corey here from Instant House Call. Whether you're a break fix tech who needs to provide remote support on demand without pre-installed software, or a managed service provider who wants to connect to unattended PCs anytime, Instant House Call makes remote support easy. I want to invite you to try Instant House Call free for yourself. Go to podnuts.com and click on the link in the show notes, then use the promo code PODNUTS. Instant House Call is the best remote support on earth. We can prove it. Try it free now and see for yourself.
Welcome to Podnuts Daily, episode number 408, a show for computer repair techs by computer repair techs. I'm your host, Jeff Halish. I'm joined today by Charlie Hoover from BostonTechCollective.com. How you doing, Charlie?
Pretty good.
Very good. Now, Charlie, if you, I'm sure you guys are familiar with the website Boston Tech Collective because Charlie's had one of his partners on the show, Yohai Gall, and they got in touch with me, and Charlie showed some interest and said, "Hey, I want to come on a show and share my knowledge." So that's why we're having him on. It's always good to have more than one person, especially from the same facility, kind of talk about what they do. So, and because everybody has their different roles, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Let's do this. Let's go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself and basically, you know, how you got started in computer repair or the computer repair business.
Oh, let's see. Let's go back. I can't really remember exactly, but somewhere in the 90s, I think. I got very interested in computers as a kid. My dad and I used to go to back in the days when they had the computer thing that you'd actually go and they'd have these big conventions and whatnot where well, not even conventions, but like at the Heinz, they'd have you'd buy components and stuff. You'd go in and they'd have everything. They'd have like vendors full of, yeah, you know, computer gear. And I forget what the Shriners.
Okay.
Memory's getting a little hazy. the Shriners. And they would have like a big thing a couple times a year, and my dad and I would go and see all the, you know, pirated software and the crazy hardware, that, you know, the 486s and 386s and all that stuff. And anyway, I got really into that, and it was actually my first real computer job was helping my dad, who at the time had a business selling and repairing handicap equipment. And I actually got in, my first couple of clients were people who needed to do speech recognition in DOS, the first versions of Dragon Dictate, because they were quadriplegic. So kind of got in doing that kind of stuff, which it was actually pretty tricky trying to get all the, you know, the auto exec batch file and all that stuff, you know, memory management in DOS was always fun.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So sort of started with that. And then fast forward a few years and I ended up, when Best Buy came into the area, I actually worked for the Evil Empire. And this was before they had Geek Squad. Got to work at the tech bench. That was around, I think, when the Y2K thing was coming through. Got to talk a lot of people off the ledge on that one.
Right.
Then from there, I actually got a job doing corporate IT and did that for, you know, basically living in a basement somewhere answering phones. that was for probably another like 5 or 6 years. And then we actually got downsized. We all got outsourced. So I found myself looking for work and stumbled across a local company that was doing in-home service and small business service. And I figured, well, why not? So I got into that, and it was really interesting because, you know, I come from doing regular IT, which is, you know, you're on the phone, you're talking to somebody, sometimes you can remote in, that kind of thing. Talking them through. You don't actually have to sit there and see them face to face. And going in person is a completely different universe, and it's a totally different skill set because you not only have to sit there and troubleshoot as fast as you possibly can because, you know, you're going hourly, but you also have to, you know, make sure that everybody is happy and likes you, and, you know, that, you know, everything is, because you can't just kind of walk in the door of someone's house and just, you know, not talk to them and kind of keep your head down and, you know, you need to talk to people.
Right.
And, so I actually found out that I actually really love doing that. So, did that for about, 10 years and, kind of got, unhappy with the way that the company was being run. And, I just happened to have a friend of mine who worked with me at the job I got outsourced from. And she contacted me because she randomly found this ad on Craigslist about someone forming a co-op. And she forwarded it on to me, and I got in touch with Yohai and went to the first meeting at the Democracy Center in Cambridge. And then from there, we formed the co-op, and it's been sort of a crazy ride ever since.
Oh, that's a great story. So you've got a lot of background in, you know, just in tech in general. Mm-hmm. Sounds like you've been all over the place. And yeah, if you're doing, you know, like the, you know, speaking software back in the DOS days, that's some good chops right there. Because I don't know, most people probably don't have those types of backgrounds, but you were able to even come up into the, you know, doing things for yourself, doing some help desk work. You know, all that kind of stuff. So that sounds, you've got a lot of different experience and I really think that sometimes is really good in this industry. Now, obviously, after you guys created the Boston Tech Collective or the co-op, you probably like this the best, wouldn't you say?
Oh yes, definitely. especially the co-op model in terms of, it actually really makes sense for IT work, you know, because the last company I worked for did the same sort of stuff, but it was very, sort of top heavy management wise.
Okay.
And there was a lot of complexity, dispatchers and just all kinds of extra complexity to things that really isn't needed anymore because, you know, you can actually do a lot more with a lot fewer people now. Between, you know, remote access and, you know, time management and just all the tools have gotten so much better that you can actually run a much more effective company with a lot fewer resources.
Right.
And that's something that and having a direct stake in it is also nice because then, you know, everybody around you, you know, they're not just... You can't just sort of sit around and hope that somebody else does something.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a real good point. And it's a unique situation because I think a lot of people that are, you know, have started off like myself as a, you know, one person shop, you know, out of my home and stuff like that. That's fine to a certain point, but a lot of times, you know, we'll go, hey, do I really want to open a shop? You know, do I want to have a brick and mortar store? And it's like to do that by yourself can sometimes be a very daunting task. And I think that, you know, what you guys are doing, and I quite honestly, this is how bad it is. Until I met you, you and Yohai, I had never heard of a co-op before, especially for computer repair. So this was new to me. And I'm like, what a great idea to have a group of people that come together, have a stake in a company, you know, basically co-owners. And you guys work within a system that just works for you as you're building and growing your business. And it's nice to have those people to, you know, kind of lean on, you know, because a lot of us are out here going, man, I don't know if I can do that. Or I'm running into this problem. I've got nobody to turn to. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, we do this show is because we're trying to do the same thing as far as getting information out there to hopefully help somebody, not only starting, but man, there's been lots of problems that I've run into that it's like, hey, I share it because I hope that it's going to help somebody else out there. And, you know, if they ever run into that problem, save them some time.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I'm actually kind of new to the whole co-op thing too. when I came into that first meeting at the Democracy Center, I didn't even really, I mean, I kind of knew what a co-op was, but, you know, over the last, you know, couple of years, I've, you know, found out that it's an entire sort of ecosystem of its own. Not with just tech-based co-ops, which there are surprisingly few, but you know all the other different kinds of co-ops that are out there, and just the mindset and the differences are pretty amazing, actually. and yeah, I actually am kind of, I do kind of regret not having started something like this sooner.
Right.
Because by myself, I never, ever would have thought of having a shop or offering, you know, a lot of the stuff that we can offer, because each one of us has sort of a specialty that we're, you know, particularly known for, or a couple of them.
Right.
And like for me, I love dealing with, you know, residential clients and all the kind of crazy, random, weird things that they go through. And you know, that sort of shared misery that they seem to have. And, and I really feel bad for them, because this stuff changes so fast. It gets so confusing that they, you know, they easily fall behind or, just get frustrated beyond belief. You know, and then, you know, Yohai is, you know, amazing with things like, you know, data recovery and business support, and our guys at the shop, Matt and Brian, you know, do really great work, with all their, you know, shop related things, you know, when it comes to, cause actually Matt is our guy who, has taken on the role of bookkeeper. So he gets the sad part of dealing with all the money. Ugh. Which I'm so happy for, cause that's just not my thing. So, you know, everybody kind of takes a role, and we just vote on things. And, if we want to do a particular kind of service, or if we want to change on a dime and start doing something else, we could with just with one meeting. It's very, very, especially with this industry, with how fast it moves, you know, dealing with new kinds of services, dealing with, you know, I remember at my last company, there was a big push against dealing with things like, you know, phones and tablets and all these new gadgets that were coming out. Nobody wanted to touch them. And, you know, there was a big, big, long argument that, you know, it basically boiled down to that nobody really wanted to deal with them, and we would have had to go through this whole structural thing. And here it's like, okay, do we want to work on this? Yes, no, okay. And, you know, it's, you know, we just vote. It's kind of nice. It's,
yeah, deceptively simple. And I think the nice thing too is so, you know, because I'm in the camp of, I very rarely will work on a tablet or phone, but just because I just really don't want to deal with them. But I see other techs out there that are making a good amount of money from doing those types of things. And I go, you know, if I had a guy or somebody else that I was working with that was really good at those things, that would be perfect. And that's kind of with your co-op, to have those people in different areas that are good at something different is great, because you could have somebody that that's all they do is tablets and phones, and they do it all day long. And you're the one shop in town that everybody comes to for that, because they know they can get it done. They can get it done quick. Whereas, you know, if you're working on, you know, machine, you know, computers, servers, you know, phones, tablets, you know, some of those things is a one man shop or a one person shop. Some of those things will tie you down.
Oh yeah.
And your turnaround time just is terrible compared to what some other shops can do. I think especially for what you guys are doing, that's awesome.
Oh yeah.
Very cool.
As a matter of fact, actually on the mobile side, we actually stopped taking them apart so much as we'll set them up and everything. But we actually found a company near us that we refer people to for that, for, you know, basically tearing apart a tablet or a phone.
Sure.
Only because we found that we really weren't doing enough to make it, you know, kind of cost effective.
Right.
Cause man, but you know, I can't tell you how many people I sit down, and especially on the residential side, and I'll sit there for hours showing them how to do, you know, how to use their phones and their tablets and their, you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, I love doing that kind of thing.
Okay.
So that's my focus.
Well, that's good, because a lot of people, you know, a lot of technicians, I think, don't want to really, there's a lot that don't want to take time to explain things to people, because it's just not their thing. It's like they just want to get in, fix a computer, hey, have a nice day, but I, you know, I got to move on to something else. So that you're actually able to sit down with people and help them, I mean, that's great in this industry, because not a whole lot of, you know, there's not a whole lot of people that can do that. So
it's kind of a weird skill set in that you know I like that's why I do the free workshops on Thursdays, and why I try to go and do, you know, community outreach stuff. I do some stuff for every once in a while. I'll do talks for you know, libraries and schools and things. Just because, you know, I'm not threatened by people knowing how things work. I feel like a lot of people that I have worked with in the IT industry are, it kind of boils down to the fact that if people really knew how some of this stuff works, you know, they might not need them as much. But I find that it's actually the opposite, where the more people find out, you know, the more power they have. And then when something really goes wrong, yeah, they might not know, they might have a vague idea how it works, but they're probably still going to call you to help them. Because, you know, even if they have a basic understanding, that actually helps them understand that maybe they are out of their depth and they shouldn't go screwing around with it. You know, maybe they shouldn't go digging through the Windows registry just because their friend told them it was a good idea. You know, that kind of thing. you know, little things.
Well, you know, I'm in the same camp you are. I totally agree. I think that the more you educate people, the better it is. The customers I'm looking for are the customers that basically don't want to deal with fixing it themselves. You know, I had somebody bring an all-in-one computer in here just a little while ago, and basically they had dropped a hutch on it and the screen was cracked. Well, that wasn't the real problem at the time. There was something else that was going on. Some updates, I think, got messed up in the Windows operating system, and it was messed up. So basically I did a reinstall for him. The kid had to pay for it. So I think he was like 12. So, you know, I cut him a break on it and everything. I'm like, hey, don't worry about it. No big deal. Accidents happen, you know. But the screen, they had bought a external monitor. And as I was headed on my bench and I'm looking at it, I'm trying to figure out how to hook an external monitor up to it. And there's no VGA, there's no DVI in this particular model because it's a cheap model. Yep. And they're all USB ports. And so I'm looking it up and I'm like going, oh, you actually have to get a external graphics adapter to be able to go into the USB port and then plug the monitor into that to make it work. So I called the customer up and told him, I said, well, here's the deal. I said, what? I said, you said you had an external monitor. I said, do you have an external graphics adapter? And he's like, well, no, we just went and bought a monitor from Best Buy. It was like $89 or whatever. And I'm like, well, that's not going to work. There's, because this model only has USB plugins. I said, right. You know, so basically I told him, I said, listen, you know, you could go to, he said, well, I've looked on eBay. I said, yeah, you can go to eBay. I said, they're about $99 for that particular screen for that, you know, computer. I said, you can go to eBay. I said, it's fairly simple to fix that one. I said, basically you know, pop the bezel off and there's four screws, pop screws out, take the ribbon cable out, plug the ribbon cable back in, put the new screen in and put the bezel back on. Because in order for me to do it, even if I give them a break, you know, they're going to be a couple hundred dollars into this $350 machine.
Exactly.
And I'm like going, I said, listen, I said, if you know, I basically gave it back to him. I said, listen, if you have a problem, once you order the screen and it looks like you can't do it or whatever, just bring it back to me and I'll fix it for you. But I would, you know, if they can do it themselves and save themselves some money on that, you know, that bad thing that happened to them, I'd rather them do that than to spend almost the same amount that they just, and this computer was 19 days old. It was sickening. So, So, you know, I agree. And, you know, you teach people a lot of things, and I always try to give people, you know, if I'm doing a virus remover or cleanup or whatever, I try, when I give it back to them, I try to get them to the point where, hey, here's a couple things that you can do to, you know, try to keep yourself safe. And I put a couple free programs on there that will help them. It's not going to avoid all the different malware and viruses and different things that are going to come in their system just from them doing day-to-day stuff. But it hopefully it's going to slow it down a little bit and help them out in the long run. So they're not having to bring it back every, you know, 3 months.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And with residential clients especially, you do try and cut them a break and sort of empathize with their situation. I don't know. Do you ever go like in person, or is it do you run out of a shop or?
Actually, I run out of my house, and I charge a cheaper price for you to bring it to me. So I actually have people bring me their computers to the shop because if I go out. Or to my house, because if I go out, it's a little bit more expensive. So, and most, and I, I advertise to a local area. It's a 6 by 6 square mile radius. There's about 93,000 people in it, and I'm happy with that. So,
fair enough. Yeah, that's cool. I mean, I kind of live on the road, so I always ask people because I drive from. I've got clients from Gloucester down to like Norwood, and just pretty much all over the bloody map.
Right.
It's just interesting to sort of get a gauge on what other people are doing.
Now, the other thing that I just started doing in my particular business too was I started doing remote support. So now I'm getting customers that call. And I'm saying, hey, let me remote in and see what's going on. And if I can fix it from a remote session, you know, I'll still charge them that flat rate. So they don't even have to bring it out or whatever. But and that's kind of saved some people some drive time. But like I said, I pretty much try to stick to just my local area.
Yeah, that's cool. A lot of it is that, the shop is in Somerville. I live out in Lowell. And so for me and for the last 10 years, I've been sort of driving from one place to another. So I've kind of gotten used to the lifestyle.
Right.
But yeah, we do a lot of remote support as well. I do probably an average of between 3 and 5 remote sort of sessions a day.
Okay.
Sometimes it's a quick thing. Sometimes it's not. Remoting in that technology, it's so nice to be able to do. Especially, what do you use for remote sessions?
I use Instant House Call.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think we're using a something called Screen Connect.
Yes.
And we love the bloody thing.
Okay,
so
cool.
There's some features we could really use on the admin side, but in terms of getting clients to use it and whatnot, it's actually pretty straightforward. So their licensing scheme is so much nicer than
okay,
because you buy the license once, there's no recurring fees.
Gotcha. Okay, no, that makes sense.
There's a little more setup. It's not quite as sleek as some of the other ones, but if you're just doing it on your own. It's actually very reasonable. You pay like, I think I want to say it's like about $300 once and then that's it.
Okay.
And yeah.
No, that is a good deal. Yeah. I use a lot more of the cloud services nowadays. So, you know, I'm kind of used to the monthly fee for a lot of things and
sure.
That's kind of how I'm building my business now. But one of the things I like is I basically embedded a little picture on my website that says get remote support, and I send them, it's right on my, well, it's actually at the bottom, at the footer. Yep. I send people there. I say, hey, click on the thing. They say, hey, do I hit run or save? I hit run. It runs it. I tell them, hey, hit the start session button and done. I don't, there's no codes or anything else. It's just dead simple. So that's why I went with that one.
Fair enough. I mean, there's a million ways to do it, but it does make it so that, like I said earlier, a smaller number of people can support a larger client base.
Yes.
So even though there's just effectively two of us in the field, our Screen Connect server, which it could easily, I mean, we have it running on premises right now, but we could easily, throw it up on EC2 or something.
Okay.
It's microscopic in terms of storage space and resources. And we probably will do that at some point. anyway, we have, I forget, but it's probably around 300 something machines at the other end of that, between business and residential.
Okay.
That we have active remote access to.
Okay.
And then we've also got the ability for someone to just go to the website. They see their name right there. We create a session really easily, and I can remote in from pretty much any device in front of me, which is
nice,
pretty handy. So
very cool.
But
No, I know Martin Obando from Obando Computing. He in the Geeksters. He uses Screen Connect, and he was excited to hear Yohai say that you guys use Screen Connect. He's like, man, I never hear anybody say they use that. And I've heard of Screen Connect in the past, and they've been around for a while. One of the things I didn't realize is that how many remote support software you know, people are out there, your companies. There's hundreds. So many. And it's like, you know, some you never even have heard of. And you're just like, how? What, wow. You know, so it's one of those things where you got to find what's going to work, you know, best for you and your business and, you know, just use that.
Exactly. There's no real wrong answer, to be honest.
No.
It just depends on, you know, what your budget is, what kind of features you're looking for, what you need it to run on, Mac, PC, that kind of thing.
Right, exactly.
You know, although I sort of tangentially related to that topic, one thing that drives me nuts are the cold callers, the ones that pretend they're from Microsoft.
Oh, I have scam artists.
I get probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 either emails or calls from clients a week about this particular scam.
Yes.
And I've actually gotten a few of the guys on the phone every once in a while. Like I was actually at a client and had them call. And the damage they do to machines and the amount of money they take from people, I just, man.
Oh, I know. I've had to, I've basically had to tell some of my customers to go down to the police station, file a police report. And I said, you know, call your credit card company. And because even nowadays, it's getting harder and harder to reverse those charges.
Yes, it is.
Because these are, believe it or not, these are legitimate companies out there. Mm-hmm. And even though they're doing the customer a disservice, the customer, you know, nobody knows that. Better Business Bureau doesn't know that. And so people are just, you know, they're paying $350 and they're putting, you know, what was the last one I saw? It was WinZip malware remover, which is actually it's an actual free product that actually exists.
But of course,
it doesn't. You know, I don't know anything about it, and I don't really know that if it does anything or not. You know, but I know that they just put a free product on their, you know, on my customer system and charge them $350.
Yep.
Sad.
Yep. Well, like, I love the, I mean, the psychology of it is interesting, where they get people to go in and look at the event viewer, and then they say, oh, well, you know, if you see anything yellow or red in there, that's bad. That means you're infected. Not realizing that it's the event viewer. It's always full of yellow and red. Like, that's
exactly.
That's what it's for. It's the little whining little corner of Windows. Like, that's what it's for. Anyway,
well, one of my customers, here's how bad, some of them are pretty slick, because they will go in and search on your computer. And if you have documents, they could be any type of documents that may or may not have your social security number on there. And they will pull that stuff up and go, hey, look, your social security number's out on the internet. And they'll show the customer right on their screen as they're remoted in. And then the customer freaks out and goes, How much is it? And they'll pay, you know, they'll pay the ransom basically to, you know, make sure that stuff is not on the internet, even though it wasn't, it was on their computer.
Yep. And my biggest beef with it is that it gives all of us a bad name because that stuff's out there.
Yes.
And that these scumbags are calling around. And by the way, I personally have this sort of theory, judging from the demographic that has been in touch with me, especially in the last, you know, few months. I really have this feeling that AARP or a similar organization, that some sort of client database of theirs, like a list of names and phone numbers, has been leaked somehow.
Oh.
Because I've been definitely noticing that the people that are getting in touch with me, and maybe it's just this might be anecdotal, but they tend to be, you know, say 50s, like late 50s and higher in age. And I feel like they're targeting seniors on purpose. So I wonder if we're eventually going to find out that something like that happened, because
that could be, because
it's a pattern that I've noticed just because I've been dealing with it so much.
I think it's the same everywhere. And my in-laws actually work at the local senior center, and basically they will have people that come in and talk about, different scams and things that are going on, and, you know, not just in the computer field, but other scams, you know, that people will call for and try to get, you know, elderly people's money. It's bad, you know, and they are unfortunately a target audience, because they figure that most of them are not very tech savvy.
Of course.
You know, and to be honest with you, that's not really an age thing. There's a lot of people that are not really tech savvy.
Oh, yeah. I would say probably like 99% of the planet.
Exactly.
Which is fine. Everybody's good at something. It's usually not tech.
Exactly. So that's why we're here, and that's why we're in business.
Hey, I fixed a network for a client who's a it was like he's a professor at, I want to say like MIT or someplace like that, and his curriculum was based around setting up corporate networks. And I actually had to go and set up his home network because, you know, his specialty was these big networks. So a tiny little, you know, just a tiny little home network of him and his wife's computers just completely baffled him. He just couldn't get it running right because he kept trying to think of these, you know, these broader concepts. So, you know, his wife finally goaded him into calling somebody and went out there and got his network set up. And, you know, sure enough, he had been setting it up as though it were a giant, you know, corporate domain, you know.
Right, exactly.
when in fact, you know, it's I think it was three computers and a printer, you know, constituted the entire network.
Right.
And he had kind of done all this elaborate stuff with this, you know, big iron firewall. And yeah, so anyway, so it just comes down to what you're used to and what your expertise are as to what, you know, what you're good at, what you're not good at. And for most people, it's definitely not anything technical. And even the people that are in the technical field, you know, everybody kind of has their specialties, you know?
I was going to say, you know how many computer engineers, computers I work on?
Oh.
A lot.
I have so many clients that either they have like friends or relatives that came over and did work on their machines or whatever, and because they're either engineers somewhere in the chain of that, because they're software developers or they do something else, and you know invariably they just don't, you know, they know enough to be dangerous but not, you know, I wouldn't want to do their job either. And
right, exactly.
You know, I do not have the patience for developing software at all. I don't, it just is not part of my brain, but, you know, I will sit there and, you know, pound away on, you know, and any other kind of, local machine problem or smaller network thing. But, you know, I know where my limits are, and, you know, people just kind of get out of their depth real fast, and they look things up on the internet, and they just sort of, you know, they dig through forums, they try to fix things themselves, or they have their, you know, their cousins or their brothers or their sons and daughters or whatever, just try and fix things for them. And
right.
It almost never works out right.
So. You know, it's amazing to me because, you know, I tell people this a lot of times that, Googling things is a skill. And
yes,
you either have it or you don't. And I'll be honest with you, most people don't. And,
no, they don't.
You know, it took me years of experience of Googling things to try, because, you know, my thing is, if you ever get into a forum or something like that, you've got, you know, 10 posts that just wasted my complete and utter time. And then, you know, one that might have sort of kind of an answer. And even nowadays, what I'm finding is I'm not getting the direct answers anymore. What I'm getting is, you know, somebody that says, you know, I Google a particular problem, and they come out and they've got something that they might have done to fix it, or a different way of thinking about it or something. And I look at it and I go, and I'm able to figure the problem out, not by what they've said, but just because they kind of moved me in my mindset into a different direction where I was able to grab onto what, yes, I needed to find in my brain to be able to fix the problem. So it's not as easy just as Googling things, and hopefully you're going to find the exact right answer for the exact situation you're dealing with.
Oh, well, yeah, the amount of bad information out there is staggering. Although I'd still tell people that, as a general rule, if they're thinking about installing something, especially if they see a pop-up of some kind, to just do a quick Google search with the name of whatever it is and the word review after it.
That's good advice. Yeah,
because 9 times out of 10, you're probably going to find out that whatever has just popped up in your face is a scam.
Yes.
You might not get very good information about it, but you can kind of get a feeling from that first page of results. You know.
Exactly.
You probably don't want to click yes to that.
That's a good point.
It's right along with my my checkboxes are evil speech.
Now, what do you normally tell people? So when you get a pop-up, and we all know that you get these illegitimate pop-ups that if you click anywhere on the window, Even the red X up in the upper right hand corner, it will launch the program in the background, and then they have some sort of ransomware that pops up in their face and says you've got 300 viruses or whatever. What do you normally tell people when that happens to them?
Well,
how to avoid it really?
Well, how to avoid it? Actually, the thing I've had that's been the most successful on that front, and which is probably the most controversial, is I'm a big proponent of, and people are going to freak out on this one, of installing things like AdBlock Plus.
Okay.
Because I've noticed from my clients that are running software like that, and I show them how it works, and I say, if you go into a website that you like or whatever, by all means, I show them how to whitelist things.
Okay.
But for most of the sites they're visiting, if it can't display the crap, they can't accidentally click on the crap. And a lot of that comes through advertising.
Yes.
Illegitimate ads are rampant, especially if they are doing random searches for things and go into these forums that are mostly loaded with crap. And even on legitimate sites, I've had the experience where, This was something a few years ago, but New York Times website, the company they did ads for through their servers got hacked, so they were serving up poisoned ads on their webpage.
Yep, I remember that.
That sort of thing happens fairly regularly, unfortunately.
Yes. Yep.
And the way I explain to people is that these companies, even legitimate ones, CNNs and whatnot of the world, they don't make the ads; somebody else does. It's all farmed out. And if anybody in that chain gets compromised, well, you get to see something you didn't want to see. by filtering out ads by default, it does cut down the amount of crap that happens to people. And I've noticed it's probably good, 3/4 reduction in calls from people saying that they accidentally clicked on something just from that. And without any other additional, I do tell them to, be careful and, if something pops up, try not to click on the window itself. Try and get to the corner, hit the X, that kind of thing. An ad filter, unfortunately, I mean, it's not that I don't want anybody to get revenue. I just, from a purely defensive standpoint, it seems to be the most bang for the buck, as it were.
Gotcha. Okay.
But I know a lot of people are sort of up in arms about the whole thing. But, I figure what it'll actually do is force people, because it doesn't block, text-based ads, sort of simpler, the really, really basic ads.
Right. So, okay.
If people went more to those, I feel like it would cut down the crap. So
very good. No, that's good. One of the things I've always told people is that I just tell them, hey, go down to the left-hand corner, the lower left-hand corner, go to the start bar, shut your computer down, and restart it back up and go continue to doing what you're doing. Because the chances are they're not going to be, that's going to shut that pop-up down. And the chances are they're not going right by that area where they just got that pop-up anyways. And it's not going to pop back up on their face, and they can go on and continue on doing what they need to do. So,
Otherwise, we've actually put a little sort of list on our website about that with, My biggest thing though is explaining to people that checkboxes are evil.
Okay.
Because people tend to just click next on things, and so my demonstration is I will install I will take them to Adobe's website to install Flash, and show them the bright yellow button that says "Oh, install," and and just say, "Okay, what would you do on this web page?" And they all go and point to the yellow button. And I said, "Ah, you see this little checkbox over here that you didn't check off? Yeah. See that thing that says McAfee security scanner? You don't want that." So I sort of teach them that. And then the way that legitimate companies, Adobe and Java with its wonderful toolbars that it tries to install.
Oh.
Because it pesters people 3 times, and I showed them. It's like, okay, comes up and says, "Oh, I have an update." You say, "Okay," it disappears. Comes up a few seconds later, "Hey, I have an update." You say, "Okay," it disappears. Then the third time, it finally says, "Okay, I'm ready to install." And then there's 2 checkboxes for like the ask.com toolbar or some other horrible thing. And if you're not paying attention, which most people at that point just don't, they just want out of their face. They just say yes, and boom, it comes in. HP printers, holy crap. The amount of crap those things put on by default is just amazing. And they hide it. They make it look like it's part of the user agreement. You know, just, it's just amazing to me. And so I show this stuff to people and, you know, just tell them, you know, just take a couple seconds, you know, yes, it's annoying to read something, but you're going to save yourself a lot of effort if you just, you know, just kind of treat everything a little bit skeptically. Do you need to do updates? Of course you need to do updates, but just make sure that the updates you actually want.
Exactly. I've speaking of Java, I've run into some things. Here's a funny thing is if you go into the Java control panel and you uncheck the box where it says check for updates ever, you'll click that. And as soon as you go back into the Java control panel, that box is checked again.
Uh-huh.
So you cannot stop Java from randomly checking for updates. You can stop it from automatically installing them, but not for checking for them. They will still annoy you and set up, you know, give you a pop-up that says you need to update Java. Well, if you're on an older system that you need to, you know, VPN to a company and you can only have a certain version of Java, you
yep.
can't update. And, yep. you know, some people are stuck. Now, do you guys use, I've been putting Unchecky on my customers' machines just because that seems to eliminate a lot of those checkbox problems.
No, I really haven't been installing anything in particular for that. Actually removing Java from most people's machines because the average, especially, you know, residential sort of home-based client, 90% of them really, really don't need it for anything. You know, I kind of go over, okay, well, what websites do you use? Blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And I tell them, you know, if you run into a website that says something about Java that you need it for something, let me know. And, you know, I can kind of walk you through it. But I've been finding most people don't even notice it's not there anymore if you just take it out.
Okay.
And that eliminates the problem entirely. As a matter of fact, I had this one client, their kid kept infecting their machine, and it was usually through some either Java exploit or Flash or whatever. So I actually removed Flash, I removed pretty much all the Adobe stuff and Java and all that stuff. I just threw Chrome on there and said, just use Chrome, because Chrome will always have the latest version of Flash. It's
right.
baked in.
Yes.
You can't not have it.
as long
as you close the browser every once in a while, that's pretty much the end of it. Is it, you know, completely secure? No, but, you know, the fewer vectors you have, the, you know, the less likely something bad will happen. So that's kind of my... I try to be a little bit more zen about it.
I'm going to have to revisit that because my philosophy is always, you know, back in the days, even with things like Foxit Reader, one of the reasons that I would install Adobe Reader is because here's what I saw on a lot of customers' machines is that they would be somewhere on some website and they could only use Adobe Reader for whatever reason.
Yes.
So
Adobe Reader is a difference. Yeah, I think I tend to leave that one alone.
Okay.
Because, yeah, I mean, like Adobe Air and Adobe
yes.
Flash and all that kind of crap. But yeah, Adobe Reader, I tend to leave on. Not
okay.
Only because most of the other PDF readers are just as bad.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know what it is about, you know, reading a PDF that has decided, you know, that there's an industry around just installing crap on your machine, but it seems to be a thing, so...
I'm hoping that most of the pop-ups that you get for like a Java, you know, my philosophy was most of the pop-ups you get for Java updates or Flash updates and stuff like that show up in a little window on the right, you know, lower right-hand corner. They're not, you know, big generally.
Yeah, it doesn't say Flash Player Pro, which is
exactly. So I tell them anything that pops up big and burly in the middle of the screen, don't mess with that at all. But the ones that are saying, hey, you have an update waiting, blah, 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 click here to install. You know, I tell them, yeah, go ahead and install those. So a lot of times, instead of them searching around online or, you know, them going to a website that says, hey, you need this, you need the Flash Player, blah, 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 and they go click on it and install some sort of, you know, malware or whatever. So there's different philosophies, and I'm not sure that there's one overall philosophy that rules them all. I'm definitely going to take a look at that because I've often wondered if I should even be putting a lot of that stuff on the customer's machines.
Yeah, so. I've really been finding that the fewer and fewer things need Flash. There's some industry-specific things. There's, like you said, older VPNs.
Yes.
And there's a handful of medical and government websites. Actually, government websites are terrible. You must be using IE6.
Are they still on IE6? Seriously?
Some of them are. Oh my yes. gosh. Actually, really horrifying thing. I have clients that do insurance, and one of my clients, they went out of business, but for they retired, so it wasn't anything like that. But basically, they had access to the RMV registry, and the draconian process involved in setting up a connection for that. And then when you sign in and you realize exactly how horribly out of date it is, you know, they're basically telnetting into this ancient it looked like DOS, but it was probably some really, really old version of Unix system. Everything was still on the 8.3 rules, so you couldn't have names or passwords or anything beyond 8 characters.
Oh, gosh.
which allegedly they were fixing. I don't know if they already have by now. I hope they have.
Okay.
And like everything was in capital letters, and like it was just this crazy, crazy process. And that's all these old government websites. So, but again, for most people, you know, if they're on Facebook or they're, you know, playing games, whatever, very few games these days are really Java based. Most of them are Flash based. So the stuff that people tend to use most I don't know. I've been having a lot of luck just ditching the stupid thing. And
right.
then if they need it, I'd say, well, then, you know, by all means go install it. Although navigating Oracle's website is sort of a fun thing in of itself.
yeah, try to find some older versions. I have to have a particular older version that I probably should keep an archived version of it because they don't have it on their website anymore.
Oh, yeah.
So that's great. It's like, really, you don't archive all your stuff, you know, even though businesses out there are using certain versions?
you know, you'd figure they would know their own clientele, but they really don't seem
to. No, they don't. They don't.
Yeah.
Nor does it seem like that they actually care. It's like, so, you know, and I try to explain to my customer in a nice way that I have had to set up older versions of Java on his machine. I said, basically, what it is you have a big company that really doesn't care if you ever get infected or you, you know, you need work on your computer all the time because you're just wide open to the web in general. And, that's basically what they're telling you. They don't care about you.
No, they're much more interested in their giant, clients. The ones who are buying all their latest, you know, services and bits and pieces, versus, you know, your, you know, small, you know, one to 10 person company. They really just, they don't care.
Yep.
It's just, yeah. You don't even rank on their radar. So, it does suck.
Now you do. So I'm going to change topics here a little bit, but,
sure.
Now I was looking at your guys' website and you said you created the website. Now, my understanding from talking to Yohai is that this is actually a Squarespace site.
Oh yeah, but by created, I mean I cobbled it together with, you know, I put all the content in and did the layout and all that. And I'm in there all the time tinkering with it. So,
I'm just surprised because I had looked at Squarespace and doing something with it, and your website looks great, and the content you have is very easy to find. But yeah, I understand that Squarespace does their own templates and stuff like that. But still, you've definitely made it look your own. You
yes.
know, in what you've done. So I'm amazed, to be honest with you.
Oh, thanks.
Looks really good.
I have no web development experience whatsoever. beyond like, back in the old GeoCities days, but, again, it goes down. I don't have the patience for programming of any kind, but, I just tried to keep it simple. I wanted so that if someone went there, they could sort of easily navigate it and, you know, it's the same approach I use with my clients when I'm on site with them is, I find that my role is actually more, it's actually fixing things and troubleshooting is actually only like a small percentage of what I feel like my job is. I feel like most of what I do on site is, probably closer to counseling. It's sort of walking people through the various stages of grief and, managing their expectations and, you know, trying to let them help them deal with all this crap that, was working one day is no longer working today.
Right.
And then, most of the time I end up having them with conversations with them about how they're using their stuff and, you know, what their goals are with it, because apparently nobody's really ever asked them those kinds of questions. They tend to just say, oh, well, you know, oh, well, you have a computer. Well, here you go. And they don't ask, oh, well, what do you use this computer for? What do you really need to do? And, you know, I set someone up. They were having a hard time with, believe it or not, their Earthlink account.
Oh my gosh.
Oh yeah. Don't even get me started. But a lot of my clients have these old systems. They have CompuServe and Earthlink and AOL, and they're still using these things. And so I walked her through the process of setting up Gmail and having it check her Earthlink account for her, and then making it so that her brand new phone and her computer, you know, did the whole IMAP synchronization thing. That completely blew her mind. Things like that. People don't realize that this stuff can actually, it doesn't have to be horrible. By the way, on the subject of AOL, I would really like those scumbags to, I at least once a month, still, I run into a client, usually a senior somewhere in their 70s or 80s, that's still paying for AOL monthly.
Kidding me.
No, I wish I was. I run into it all the time where, and if anybody in the audience, you know, has anybody that is elderly or still uses AOL or whatever, just ask them if they're still paying for it, because I'll bet you they are. And I run into clients that have been paying for the last, you know, decade or however long, a couple decades, 20, 25 bucks, whatever it is, a month for no reason. And I every time I run into a client that has an AOL address, I ask them if they're paying for it, and almost always, especially the older ones, they're always saying, "Oh yeah," because they don't know they're not supposed to. And then if you get AOL on the phone and you try to cancel, holy crap, do they make it seem like that's a bad idea? Because they come up with a list of all these things that they're doing for you that, you know, the client never knew they had, like all this sort of BS, you know, benefits that they have.
Right.
I mean, it's really like this quiet little scumbag part of the industry that I don't think really people know about, because seniors tend not to report that kind of stuff. They don't even know what's happening. So I get really, really angry. I've yelled at quite a few people at AOL in the last, you know, several years over that exact problem.
Can you still use the AOL mail for free, even if you're not paying for the service? Okay.
Yes. And downgrading yourself from the paid tier to the free tier does nothing for your email. It does absolutely jack.
Gotcha.
It's they're just bilking mostly seniors out of, you know, 20 to 25 bucks a month.
That's sad.
Think about how much of AOL's revenue might actually be made on that. And that just, it just twists my stomach. It's probably not a lot. It's probably, you know, less than a million people. You know, but that's still a million people that are getting bilked for no reason.
But, you could get, an Office 365 Exchange, for $5.
Oh, yeah.
If you really wanted to pay for mail, but why would you pay for AOL?
Or they could keep their AOL account if they wanted to. I mean, it does support IMAP. It does use SSL. It's not horrible. Well, I mean, it's horrible because it's AOL, but it's just, you know, there's no reason for them to be paying for it. They don't get anything for the money. And they could be, even if they bought, I mean, you know, they could be running, you know, like you said, you know, a 4 to 5, you know, Office 365 or Google Apps accounts off of that, the amount of money they're paying AOL.
Yeah, exactly. That's ridiculous. And
most of them are on fixed income too. So that's where it also just drives me nuts. So,
well, and I don't really think they've up. So the, I don't think they've updated the AOL software in forever.
No,
it's been a long time.
They tend to drive people to the website now.
Well, here's something that, now that you said this, I think they've done it on purpose, is that software, when you try to get an attachment off of there now, and this has only been within the last 6 or 8 months, maybe. Mm-hmm. It's downloaded as a winmail.dat file, which is nothing. So there's nothing there. So you actually have to either put it into Outlook, something like Outlook or Thunderbird or whatever, or go to the website, which is how I've had to set some of my customers up, is actually going to the website so they can get their attachments that they need from the companies that are sending them out. Yep. So now that you said that, I think they've done that. They probably have done that on purpose to get people off of that old software.
Yeah. And if you call them up, they, I don't know. I'm on the phone with, you know, all the worst companies in the world all the time, you know, Comcast and Verizon and all them, but AOL kind of took the cake, whenever I have to call them, and I always do whenever, I mean, I will, just on principle, switch my time off in terms of what I'm billing the client just to get on the phone to yell at them.
Okay.
Cause it's usually a fairly short conversation, usually, less than half an hour, but, yeah, and when people are being taken advantage of like that, and they just don't know it, that's when I get really angry. So
yeah, that's
I just forgot to put that out there.
That's good.
In case anybody else runs into it,
because I guess from my mindset, I thought that it had gone to a free email system, and I didn't realize that there are people that are still paying for it. So that's something I need to check with some of my customers, because there are some that are still on AOL.
Oh yeah,
you know.
Yeah, then they're never going to use anything else because they're.
It's what they're used to.
That's what they're used to. Yep. They've been using it for a million years. Getting them to switch to something like Gmail or something would probably be too painful. So it's fine, but paying for it is ridiculous.
Right. Absolutely.
You know. So anyway, that's a random rant.
No, that's good. That's good information, because like I said, I was even unaware of some of those things. So. In your business, on a day-to-day basis, what are some, maybe favorite tools, software, or hardware that you use that you couldn't live without?
Let's see. Primarily on the Windows side, I would say, the first thing I hit a machine with, I shouldn't say that. If I'm doing just general troubleshooting, unless I know there's something specifically wrong, like a power supply, or like if I'm not looking for like a hardware problem, if it's like an infection or something.
Yeah.
Typically, my two go-to things are biggest one is Hijack This.
Okay.
Which I realize is kind of an old school utility, but what I love doing with it is I'll run it as soon as I get in front of the client's machine. And bring up the list of crap, and it makes a really good. I consider on-site work to be almost like a performance art in a way.
Good point. Yes.
So, just to sort of show them what's going on, I bring up the Hijack This screen with all the long column of stuff, and just say, I realize this is going to look like it's in Japanese. It's fine. But just so you know, these are all the things that are starting up when the computer turns on. And then I start just kind of eyeballing through, because I've seen I've sort of a black belt and Hijack This. so I can just trim the crap out of a machine just from that quick little utility. Anyway, I just go through and I can very quickly eyeball and figure out just from that, almost anything I need to know about not only the machine, but if you read it right, you can almost read into the kind of person that is actually running the machine. You can almost develop like a sort of a personality profile just based on that.
Okay.
And again, it's just because, I've done it thousands and thousands of times. I'll bring that up and I'll use it, to purge some of the dumber things, that kind of thing.
Right. Sure.
If I want to do any real heavy cleaning, I tend not to do it from within the operating system. I tend to boot up, using my other favorite tool, which is, Parted Magic.
Okay.
I don't know if you have ever used it or not.
I have not.
It's this wonderful Linux distro. I don't think it's actually free anymore, although you can get an older version of it. And basically it's a, full Linux, distro that's geared around primarily data recovery.
Okay.
So when you first launch it, it comes up to a very, very no-frills desktop where you can run diagnostics and whatnot on the hard drive. We actually use it at the shop. It's the first thing that gets run on any machine that comes in, regardless of the problem. Mostly because we, and this was actually something Yohai brought in that I hadn't really thought of before, which was if someone's, no matter what their problem is, if their hard drive is starting to go, we need to let them know that before we do any other work. And right. It's good for us to know because then we won't fix something and have the hard drive die, you know, like a week later or something. But anyway, so part of Magic is part of that strategy. So, but within there, it also has sort of all the usual sort of Linux-based tools like password resetters and, you know, file explorers and whatnot. And, you know, I'll go through there and run, you know, antivirus and you know, run manual purges through things. You know, those are kind of my two big ones. I use a variety of other things as well,
sure,
depending on what the problem is. But, you know, what I love about part of Magic is that it is a Linux distro. You know, you can use, there's a million of them out there, obviously, but I like that it easily fits on a flash drive. It boots up pretty quick. It'll run on almost anything, even in command line. And it's got pretty much every sort of basic tool you're going to need to work on a machine. So it's just it'll even do, it has all the, you know, like drive cloning and all that other stuff too. So it's a good little Swiss Army knife. So I just keep that on one of my flash drives and, you know, that combined with, you know, hijack this for a quick diagnosis and, you know, I try to keep my tools to a bare minimum.
Gotcha. Okay.
So,
no, that makes sense.
You know, because in the field, and my general rule is if there seems to be something wrong with a machine that is taking me, you know, say more than an hour to fix, you know, then I start leaning either towards, you know, rebuild or replace kind of territory, because I just don't want to have anyone sort of sit there and, you know, have to spend $1 million to get their, you know, their, especially if it's an older machine. Yeah, I'd much rather, you know, sit down with someone and walk them through the process of buying a new one than to have them spend a fortune to replace a, you know, or to fix, and then not necessarily be able to trust an older machine. So,
right. Yeah. I have a rule. Usually if it's 4 or 5 years old and they're having a major issue and it's going to be a, you know, kind of costly fix, I'll point them in that direction and hey, you know, you might want to think of, instead of spending this money on this, let's just get a new machine. We'll move your data over. We'll set this machine up. We'll get you running, and you're going to be better off for it than paying me to fix this older machine that's, you know, something else could actually go wrong with it that we're not aware of right now. So,
if
you're doing you're on site, you're doing a virus removal or something like that. Do you guys do any nuking paving, as the industry says nowadays?
Oh, what do you mean? Like, you know, back up, blow everything away and start over?
Exactly.
I try to avoid it if I'm on site, just because it is a very, you know, sort of time intense sort of project. For stuff like that, if I really think it's necessary and worth their money, what I'll usually do is you know, bring something like that to the shop and let them do it, because we'll do it at the shop for a flat fee and they won't be, you know, charged for me sitting around waiting for updates and all that kind of stuff. So it tends to be a cheaper thing if I bring it to the shop.
Yeah.
And then it's just a cost of, you know, sort of dropping off and picking up. But I mean, I try to make sure that their machine is at least serviceable. Even if it is a very old machine, what I'll often do is get it working well enough so they can then go and buy a machine. So it's sort of a jury rig, and then I'll sit there and work with them on, you know, actually sit there and go on Amazon or Newegg or someplace and, you know, buy the machine with them.
Right.
And say, okay, well, here's the things you need. Here's what we want to get, blah, blah, blah. And just have them order it and then come back and set it up. So if it's a really old machine, I usually try to get that on the, like, talk to them on the phone before I even come out.
Okay.
And if I can get that kind of information, great. Sometimes I don't. I mean, I had a guy who called me out, and he was very upset that his computer wasn't working anymore. And it turned out it was a Pentium 1 laptop. that he was using dialed up to, I think actually it was AOL.
Oh.
And he considered that his new computer. And his old computer, yeah, his old computer was an IBM XT that was sitting on his dining room table in the next room over. And I was just like, yeah, there's really nothing we can. I think the machine was running, I want to say, like Windows 95, Windows 98.
Okay.
And this was not that long ago. This was like a year ago.
Oh, my gosh.
And I just walked in. I'm like, I can't. You need a new machine.
Right.
I would love to help you, but there's a rabbit hole here that is going to cost you so much money. I didn't actually end up charging him either. I was just like, here, you know, let's just pretend it didn't come here. And I gave him some advice on what to get and said, you know, let me know when you get it and I'll come back. And, you know, I came back and set him up. I got him over to DSL, which was the only option he had in his area.
Okay.
And it was actually cheaper than the dial-up he was still paying for. So it was kind of a win-win, but
right.
The poor guy, you know, cause when he originally, you know, got in touch with me, I thought, you know, when people say old computers, they don't usually really mean it.
exactly.
So.
Oh, that's funny. Now, when you're doing like a data, you know, you're backing up data or stuff like that, what I've noticed is now a lot of people will tell me this is different. I'm averaging between 28 and 60 gigs of data when I'm backing up somebody's computer. I don't know why. I mean, I do know why. There's, you know, it's iTunes. A lot of stuff. Well, not just, maybe pictures iTunes. Yeah, pictures and videos, you know, family videos and stuff like that.
Yep.
I'm not even seeing like the illegitimate videos and stuff like that anymore. That's not part of this whole data set. But that takes a good hour to back up. So now would you do something like that on site or would you just go, I need to take this back to the shop and work on it there?
It depends on the time and distance they are from the shop.
Okay.
You know, the further they are from the shop, the less likely I'd in a situation where it involves like say a new machine. Typically, what I will do is I will just order something, come back, and then I'll just take the old hard drive out, attach it temporarily to the new machine, and just transfer the data directly.
Okay.
And then I leave them with that original drive. I take it out of the old machine and just give it to them as a backup. And then get them on something cloud-based, like, you know, Carbonite, Black Backblaze, something like that.
Okay.
Just so that there's, you know, a safety net going forward. But, unless their drive is really a mess and then, like if they need actual data recovery, like something horrible has happened, and the drive is actually failing, then I'll drag just that back to the shop.
Sure.
I won't even bother with the computer.
Right.
For data transfer, I don't generally do just a backup if I'm on site, unless there's a lot of other things going, because I tend to be very much a multitasker. It comes from my old days in the IT department where I'd be working on four or five machines at the same time.
Right.
So you kind of get into that mindset of sort of juggling tasks. If I'm at a residential client or even a business and there's a lot of things going on, then I might do a data backup just because it'll work while I'm working.
Gotcha. Okay.
But I try not to just sit there and stare at a progress bar if I can avoid it.
I gotcha.
Although it does give opportunity sometimes for, you know, teaching them something, you know, showing them how to use their phone or, you know, how to, I try to use any downtime in between other big tasks to teach them something about their gadgets that they don't know about. I mean, I've been setting up more TVs and, what do you call it? Thermostats and.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Pretty much if it's even slightly computerized, I will offer to give them a hand with it. I mean, I helped someone program their porch lights the other day. Just because it's technically a computer and it only took me a couple minutes to figure out the interface. I tend not to draw the line at anything. So I set up Rokus and Xboxes and, all kinds of things, smart TVs. Pretty much if it's a gadget, I will play with it and I will, you know, either teach them how to use it or set it up. So, and that's just my own sort of, you know, love of playing with these things. So I never say no unless I know I can't actually, I either have no interest or no real expertise or like I just don't care about that particular kind of thing. you know, like I, if someone wants their website built for them, I usually refer them out, you know, either to my coworker or someone else. You know, like anything along those lines, anything I'm not interested in, I won't help with. But you know, I'm generally interested in gadgets as a rule, so I will set up anything they want. So, or you know, so
yeah, Charlie, you are a rare gem. I will tell you that. Not a lot of people will do that, those types of things. You know, they want to get in, get out. And, you know, I like dealing with people and I like helping people with their problems. But I know for myself, I really like people bringing their machines to me because I really don't want to go out and hang out in their house. So,
yeah.
but you multitask and do all kinds of things that, you know, are beneficial to the customer. And that in itself is great customer service. And you're not going to get that every place that you go. That's for sure. So
no, good. It was actually frowned upon in my last place, but, I guess it's just that, my philosophy is that, everybody's good at something. It's not usually computers. So while I'm there, you know, the first, like, after I ask them what's going on with their computer, while I'm sort of tinkering with it or whatever, you know, the second thing I always ask is, what do you do for a living? Like, what do you, you know, because I really actually love finding out, because I've met some fascinating people over the years.
Right.
And I'm much more interested in finding out what's going on in their life. Because honestly, you know, if you've cleaned one infection, it's not a terribly, like, I can probably do it in my sleep. A lot of the sort of more mundane tasks, juggling Outlook profiles or transferring data or cleaning up an infection or whatever. So most of the time I spend is actually talking to them and finding out, you know, what they do for a living and what their day to day is. And it tends to throw people a little bit, but what I find is that, you meet some really interesting people that way, and B, you develop a relationship where, you know, they tend to think of you more as a friend than just somebody who only shows up when things blow up.
Right.
And then sort of C, if something does go wrong, if you know, some horrible thing happens, I don't know what, but just, you know, something just doesn't go right. They are way, way, way more forgiving of somebody that actually seem to take an interest in their personal life. You know, they tend not to flip out as much if something goes wrong or you know, you have to give them bad news, like, you know, their you know, data's gone or something like that. It's a much more healthy approach, I think. It just diffuses a lot of situations down the road. Especially if you can remember later on, oh yeah, you know, this guy has a, you know, his kids, you know, they're off at, you know, X, Y, or Z college, or, you know, I mean, I've been doing this long enough that a lot of my clients have been going to, I've literally witnessed their kids, you know, grow up over the years. You know, I only see them like maybe once a year, or once every other year in some cases. But you know, you really do kind of build a long-term relationship with certain people, and you sort of learn their personality after a while. And that's actually one of the things I love the most about being in the field.
Right.
I think there is a part of me that would, you know, that loves the idea of sort of, you know, like you said, like having people bring stuff to me, and, you know, by all means, I still, you know, will do that. But being in people's sort of space is actually kind of a fascinating psychological journey. You learn a lot about someone by being in their environment, and things that you wouldn't necessarily pick up on from a remote session.
Right.
So you know, just looking around, you can see like the things they like, the things they're into, the everything about their personality sort of pours out. So yeah.
Well,
it's weird.
Well, it's one of those things, and it's a rule that I think is true even nowadays. He who has the best customer service wins. And I think that's definitely you guys got something special going on there with all that, you know, with all the stuff that you guys are doing and the different things that you bring to the co-op. And I think that's fascinating. I know we had Yohai on here a couple episodes ago, and he talked about, you know, the co-op and the different intricacies of putting a co-op together and doing mm-hmm. all kinds of things. But I really appreciate you coming out and sharing with us, you know, what you do in that co-op and on your side of the business. If people wanted to get in contact with you, what would be the best way to do that?
Ooh, well, email is always, always a good way. Charlie@BostonTechCollective.com or, probably the best way to get in touch with me, especially for anything on, you know, any other techs or whatever. Just find me on Google Plus because that's where I hang out the most. And I'm just google.com/ I think it's just plus Charlie Hoover.
Okay.
By all means, come and participate with my geek question of the day or anything else that that happens to be going on. So,
yeah, I just started. I just hooked up with you over there and started following you. You got some very interesting questions of the day. So yeah, it's good information.
About the people that are answering them. Yeah. Yeah. There's very little that happens that's very technical. I'll just say that. But it's mostly my way of blowing off steam. So.
There you go. No, that's great. Well, again, appreciate you coming out and sharing with us today. And you guys can find me over on the Google Plus at Jeffrey Halish or Twitter at TechNutPC. And if you have any questions or would like to be a guest on the show, please email me at podnutsdaily@podnuts.com. If you want to leave a voicemail, we'll listen to those on the air. Please give us a call at 1-888-697-0162. And I want to thank our sponsor of this episode, Instant House Call. Just appreciate you sponsoring this episode. And don't forget, if you need business paperwork to get you started in your computer repair business, then check out the link for the TechNibble Computer Business Kit over at podnuts.com. And if you guys could, please leave us a rating and review over on iTunes. That way more people can find out about us. And when we got fresh content over there, the show comes out every week. You guys can also help support the Podnuts Network. The next time you're shopping at Amazon, please go to podnuts.com/Amazon. Remember, that doesn't change your price at all. Puts a little change in the pockets of the Podnuts Network to bring you these awesome shows. And I want to thank everyone for listening and subscribing to the show. We'll see you next time on Podnuts Daily.
Hi, folks. Lisa here from Call That Girl's Remote Support Show. Did you know that I have a brand spanking new show coming out called Call That Girl's Office 365 Show? You can check it out right here on the Podnuts Network by going to podnuts.com/CTG. Listen to all of my day-to-day problems and solutions I have with Outlook, third-party apps, and Office 365.
Music provided by Steve Cherubino at stevecherubino.com.